Israel now has control over a key part of Gaza.
And Israel has actually called it, quote, Hamas's oxygen pipeline for smuggling weapons.
Plus, Antony Blinken visits Ukraine's neighbor.
Today, I'm announcing that we'll be working with our Congress to provide an additional $50 million to further advance these efforts, from reforming the energy and agricultural sectors to pushing back further against disinformation.
And later, an update from Kyiv. A look at where North Korean missiles were found, and a protest that's been going on for 1,000 weeks. Today is Thursday, May 30th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll start off today in Israel. Amid the ongoing Gaza war, Norway, Ireland, and Spain have formally recognized the state of Palestine this week. As expected, Palestinians welcomed the move, while Israel sharply condemned it. VOA's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Ireland, Norway, and Spain join more than 140 nations that have already recognized a Palestinian state. Noor Oda is a Palestinian journalist.
Recognition is not a symbolic act. This is a legal and political step, a commitment that countries make. It involves recognition of territory, of borders, of sovereignty. And as such, that will have legal implications and legislative implications for those countries.
Israelis reacted angrily to the decision, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calling it a prize or reward for terrorism. Some Israeli analysts interpret it as further evidence that the world's moral compass has gone adrift. Dan Diker is the president of the Jerusalem Center for Foreign Affairs.
The extraordinary act of recognizing a Palestinian state on the heels of the worst mass murder in one day in modern political history against any democratic country underscores the absurdity, and I would even call it the diplomatically violent decision that these countries have taken.
Polls suggest more than three-quarters of the Israeli public do not support a Palestinian state in the aftermath of October 7th, when Hamas invaded more than 20 Israeli communities and killed about 1,200 people. Since then, there has been a bloody war between Israel and Hamas that the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says has killed more than 36,000 Palestinians. Some Israeli analysts say the recognition by the three European countries. Gershon Baskin is a former Israeli negotiator with Hamas and a longtime proponent of a Palestinian state.
The recognition of Palestine and the entry of the state of Palestine into the United Nations as a member state of the United Nations begins a process where, when we return to negotiations, the question of Palestinian statehood is determined. It is no longer a veto that Israel has over the question of Palestinian statehood.
The U.S. and several European countries are advocating for an eventual Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, following a ceasefire in Gaza and release of all the Israeli hostages. But in the meantime, they oppose the unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And Linda Gradstein joins us again for some more news, this time a developing story from near Rafah. The Israeli military announced on Thursday that it now controls an area in Gaza called the Philadelphia Corridor. I spoke with Linda about what that is and why it's important.
So it is a strip of land that runs for a total of 8.7 miles along the Gaza-Egypt border between, so it really divides Gaza and Egypt. And Israel has actually called it, quote, Hamas's oxygen pipeline for smuggling weapons. Israel discovered when they took over this route, and they were, you know, worried a little and careful about not involving Egypt in this conflict, but they found dozens of rocket launchers and at least 20 cross-border smuggling tunnels so far.
So if this is one of the main ways, perhaps the biggest way that Hamas is getting their weapons, this is a pretty significant achievement for the Israeli military.
Yes, I mean, that's what Israel is saying. You know, Israel says, first of all, that the last bastion of Hamas. The only place that it really has a full brigade is in Rafah. Israel also says that they believe that the hostages, at least some of them, are being held in Rafah. So Israel has said that it really sees no option except for taking over Rafah. And taking over the Philadelphia route will now, I think, make it easier for Israel to fight Hamas in Rafah as well.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Israelis tried very hard not to involve Egypt. Is that because they don't want to upset the Egyptians who are intentionally supplying the Gazans, or is it because the Egyptians are backing off? What's the politics there?
Well, Israel has a peace treaty with Egypt. And in fact, you know, Israel and Egypt have been cooperating in trying to fight against Hamas. Now, these tunnels, apparently it's not the Egyptian government that has been supplying weapons. It's private people. And, it's not coming from the Egyptian government. At the same time, Israel does not want Egypt involved in this conflict. Earlier this week, there was an Egyptian soldier killed in a clash with Israeli soldiers, which was, as far as I know, the first time this has happened since the war began in October. And so Israel is being very careful. It's sharing intelligence with Egypt, and it really does not want Egypt involved. At the same time, Egypt is afraid that tens of thousands of Palestinian refugees from Gaza will try to storm the border and come into Egypt. So, Egypt has an interest in sort of making sure that this war doesn't expand beyond Gaza. So, it seems that Israel and Egypt actually have joint interests right now when it comes to what should happen. And again, it's important to say that there is a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt dating back to the 1970s.
And we'll leave it there for today. Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks always for your time.
Thanks, Steve.
Turning our attention now towards Europe. On a visit to Moldova on Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced an additional $135 million in aid to help Ukraine's neighbor fight off Russian disinformation and strengthen its energy resilience. Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports.
While Russia's war against Ukraine has brought serious challenges to the European continent, Moldova, with the help of the United States, continues to stand strong, said its president, Maya Sandu, during a press conference Wednesday with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We managed here in the Republic of Moldova to maintain peace, stability, the communist spirit, in spite of all the attempts of destabilization.
Blinken noted that since February 2022, the United States has provided $774 million to strengthen Moldovan institutions and push back on Russian attempts to undermine Moldova's commitment to democracy. About $300 million of these was earmarked for energy security.
Today, I'm announcing that we'll be working with our Congress to provide an additional $50 million to further advance these efforts, from reforming the energy and agricultural sectors to pushing back further against disinformation.
Moldova's moves to shift to a more diversified economy, free from Russian energy dependence, will also receive a financial boost, Blinken added.
We will also be dedicating $85 million, part of the $300 million USAID effort to support energy infrastructure, to help you enhance things like battery storage, as well as the high-voltage transmission lines that we've already dedicated some funds to.
As Ukrainians continue battling Russian forces in Kharkiv and other regions, both Blinken and Sandu reiterated their country's support of Kyiv and their commitment to not allow Moscow to continue its aggression against Ukraine with impunity. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
Russian forces launched another massive missile and drone attack as Ukraine gets some victories at sea. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Before dawn on Thursday, Russian forces launched a massive missile and drone attack across Ukraine. One of the main targets of the attack was the city of Starokonstantiniv in Khmelnytskyi region, where an airfield is located. In addition, a ballistic missile hit infrastructure sites in Kharkiv. 7 people were injured. The city of Kharkiv remains under constant shelling as Russian forces are trying to break through the Ukrainian defenses to advance closer to the city. In his evening address, President Zelensky mentioned that Ukraine is preparing for any further Russian offensive in different areas. Right now, though, the fiercest battles are happening in the Donetsk and Kharkiv regions. Meanwhile, in the early hours of May 30th, explosions were heard in Kerch in the occupied Crimea. Local authorities appointed by the Russian government reported the damage to a vehicle and railway ferries. It is believed to have been caused by Ukrainian attacks. Later, the intelligence service of Ukraine confirmed the destruction of two Russian boats and showed a video of the attack. This is another successful sea drone attack by the Ukrainian forces in the past months. While the Russia-Ukraine war shows no signs of ending, 1.3 million Ukrainian conscripts updated their military data through the newly created online service. This is as a part of the new mobilization bill that was signed by President Zelensky in May. According to the new rules, all Ukrainian men from 25 to 60 years old have to update their personal data within 2 months after the bill was signed. The Ministry of Defense says that approximately 27% of those who updated their data currently have deferrals. At the same time, the Ministry of Defense spokesman noted that Ukraine is not planning to mobilize such a large number of people at the same time. However, it is important that the state has a full understanding of a number of potential conscripts who can join the armed forces when needed. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The China-North Korea friendship may be showing signs of strain. We'll take a look in a few minutes. Now, though, back to Ukraine. Anna Chernikova told us how Kharkiv has been under near constant attack for weeks and that it's the site of some of the worst fighting and most destruction. Despite all this, most residents are still there. Lucia Bakalets talked to some women about why they decided to stay.
The volunteers of the Animal Rescue Kharkiv risk their lives to evacuate animals from frontline villages as Russia renews its attempt to seize the Kharkiv region. Ярина Вітонтюк, communications manager for Animal Rescue Kharkiv, says they get hundreds of phone applications. She says people on the front lines were already under occupation in 2022, so everyone fled quickly now, and many couldn't take their animals with them. There are 120 employees and volunteers in the Animal Rescue Kharkiv Center. All have chosen to stay. How can we go if we are needed here, Vitantuk asks. She says this was their conscious choice in 2022 when the full-scale invasion began. Vitantuk says her team didn't even have a discussion. They all stayed to save the animals. Vitantuk says in May they rescued more than 1,000 animals in the Kharkiv region alone. Vitantuk says they treat animals, find them a new home, and they keep doing as much as they can. She says this is their small contribution to Ukraine's victory. Contributing to victory is also the goal of Maria Kornienka, the co-owner of a Kharkiv bakery which opened 4 months ago. Maria Kornienka, one of the Bulkinski bakery's owners, says that 6 months ago they won a grant for small business finance. Without hesitation, she says, they decided to open a bakery in Kharkiv. The opening happened as the city was getting shelled. Kornienko said that she recently counted 13 explosions in 1 hour, but she doesn't want to relocate the business. Kornienko says donors immediately offered to move the bakery to Poltava or Kyiv, but she says she and the others refused. She says they will keep working for the citizens of Kharkiv as long as they can. The bakery offers more than sourdough bread. Kornienko says people in nearby home have electric stoves, so when the power goes out, people come to the bakery with thermoses for boiling water to make tea or cook some food.
Не могли їсти собі приготувати, тому вони знали, що можна прийти до нас в пекарню.
Mariana Mats says the reason she doesn't leave Kharkiv is personal.
Я не виїжджала з міста, тому що він був тут.
Mariana Mats, the widow of a fallen Ukrainian soldier, says that at first she didn't leave the city because her husband was serving in the military on the eastern front line. She says he died at the end of last year, but she feels like he's forever in Kharkiv. So staying here is a way for her to be close to him somehow. Now Mariana volunteers for her late husband's unit and says she has gotten used to the explosions. Леся Бакалець, VOA News.
And now to Asia, where tensions between North Korea and China have surfaced publicly this week for the first time in years. The apparent rift between the two allies emerged as North Korea's attempt to launch a spy satellite interrupted a major diplomatic initiative by Beijing. VOA's Bill Gallo has more from Seoul.
This wasn't the first time North Korea has tried to launch a spy satellite, which it wants to monitor U.S. forces in the region. But the launch, which ended in a fiery explosion shortly after liftoff, was unusual because of the timing. North Korea announced it would conduct the launch just as China's premier was set to meet the top leaders of Japan and South Korea. It was a rare North Korean disruption of a major political event involving China, its main ally. A small detail, perhaps, but analysts say it hints at trouble in the relationship. Jean Lee is a Korea specialist at the East-West Center.
North Korea is very strategic in the timing of its launches. They do not do things by chance.
The timing left China's premier in an awkward position, as his counterparts condemned the impending launch. Things only got more awkward. After a joint statement called for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, North Korea erupted. In state media, North Korea's foreign ministry accused the three countries of interfering in its internal affairs. Again, Jean Lee.
The fact that they mentioned China as well really jumped out at me, because I think it hints at the fissures in this relationship between North Korea and China.
The last time North Korea criticized China was in 2017, when Beijing backed UN sanctions over the North's nuclear and missile tests. Since then, ties have improved. China now opposes new sanctions. But some analysts see signs of trouble beneath the surface. Chinese leader Xi Jinping hasn't met Kim Jong-un in over 5 years. Ramon Pacheco Pardo is a professor at King's College London.
I think that if China wanted, and Xi Jinping especially, wanted to show that there is a close relationship between itself and North Korea, Kim Jong-un had been invited already to China, or had been essentially dragged to China to meet with Xi Jinping, and this hasn't happened.
Kim has met with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who now uses North Korean missiles to wage war in Ukraine. In return, Putin may be aiding North Korea's nuclear weapons program, according to U.S. officials. Some analysts say China may be uncomfortable with a significant nuclear buildup on its border, which may help explain the current tensions. Again, Ramon Pacheco Pardo.
China is trying to show that it is not as close to North Korea and to Russia, to be honest, as some imply.
But all three countries have seen their relations with the United States deteriorate, meaning they may continue to find plenty of reasons to cooperate. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
In a related story, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency is now confirming that Russia has used North Korean-made missiles in its attacks on Ukraine. The DIA says missile debris found in Kharkiv in January was from a North Korean short-range missile. For more, visit our website, voanews.com. And elsewhere in Asia on Thursday, 14 pro-democracy activists were found guilty in Hong Kong, while two were acquitted. Kylie Vaughn has the details.
These verdicts in Hong Kong come more than 3 years after police arrested 47 pro-democracy supporters in home raids across the city. They were charged with conspiracy to commit subversion under a national security law imposed by China. Sentencing will come later for those found guilty, with prison terms ranging from 3 years to life for this offense. Emily Lau is a Hong Kong pro-democracy activist.
Because right now, There's not much press freedom, not much freedom of expression, and no freedom of assembly, and no freedom of demonstration. People are very frightened. I don't think many people dare to talk to you. So Hong Kong was not like that a few years ago. So we have to go back to those days.
Those convicted include prominent former Democratic lawmakers Lee Yong Kwok Hung, Lam Chuk Ting, and Helena Wong, while barrister Lawrence Lau and social worker Lee Yue Shun were acquitted. It's not clear whether any would appeal, with the court adjourned until an afternoon session. This is Kylie Vaughn with VOA News.
And finally today, Turkey's longest-running peaceful protest entered its 1,000th week in May. A group known as the Saturday Mothers holds a silent vigil each week demanding justice for relatives who disappeared after being detained by security forces. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The posters show faces of Turkey's forcibly disappeared. Amongst the youngest, a 13-year-old shepherd called Davut. Relatives say he and others vanished while in custody of security forces. For 1,000 weeks, the Saturday Mothers, named after a similar campaign in Argentina, has held a silent vigil demanding to find out what happened to their relatives. Hanife Yildiz is one of those demanding justice. She says she is here because her son disappeared while in custody. She says the authorities told her there was no detention, but she says she took her son to the police station herself. Unfortunately, she says she and others have been here for 29 years, for 1,000 weeks. She says she and others have been looking for justice. Most of the hundreds of forced disappearances occurred in the 1990s, at the height of the Turkish state's war against the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. But other disappearances go back to the years of military rule in the 1980s. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, then serving as Prime Minister, met in 2011 with some of the Saturday Mothers and promised justice. There were criminal investigations and even trials for those responsible for the forced disappearances, but all ended in acquittal. In recent years, the state has cracked down on the mothers, declaring their protests subversive. Istanbul's Galatasaray Square, where they meet, is now permanently sealed off, with authorities usually allowing only a weekly token presence of 10 people. Emma Sinclair Webb is a senior Turkey researcher for Human Rights Watch.
In the period, especially of the early 90s, 92 to 94 mostly, an enormous number of mainly men were arrested and never seen again. As if those in power cannot bear to have these women and these relatives of the disappeared meeting every Saturday and presenting them with the crimes that the state committed.
The Saturday Mothers' 1,000th week anniversary drew an outpouring of support across social media, and there's even a pop music video commemorating their struggle. A struggle, the Saturday Mothers say, will continue until they find justice for their lost relatives, says Birsen Karakoç, who's been searching for her brother, Ridvan, since the 1990s. Karakoç says, we are trying to explain that our disappeared are not orphans. We're trying to learn about their fate. She says we're trying to understand why they were tortured to death. We want justice, she says. That is why we are here every week. For 30 years we have been here, since the first week, and we will continue to be here. At the end of the ceremony, Birsen's brother, Hasan, places flowers to remember the forcibly disappeared, calling out that until all of them are found and those responsible are brought to justice, they will never give up, a sentiment shared by all those present. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Till tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.